VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And thank you for joining us on Crosstalk today here on VCY America. I have a question for you folks. How many times have you heard the phrase over the past 12 months, follow the science? I mean, you hear it in relation to so-called man-made global climate change. You've heard it many times in regard to COVID, the masking, the COVID shot, and in many other venues as well. But one place you never hear it is from those who espouse transgenderism, do you? Follow the science, okay? We're male or female. But that's another topic, and we'll hit that another day. But this follow the science mantra has been front and center. Our guest today is going to share with us why evolution is bad science. With us, we welcome in our studio today Helmut Welk. He is president of the Quad City Creation Science Association, also a retired engineering manager with a Fortune 100 company. He holds both bachelor's and master's degrees in industrial engineering, also a member of the Creation Research Society, a speaker on creation science topics across the nation, and president of Creation Summit. Helmut, good to have you here.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be here.
I'm confident there are many who have never heard of the Quad City Creation Science Association, so give us a word about the organization.
Okay. Well, about 12 to 14 years ago, we had a group of laymen primarily from about four different churches, and we were friends, and we were realizing that there was so much good stuff coming out about science breakthroughs, and they were all breaking for the Bible, for the creation account, and basically debunking evolutionary theory. But we don't hear about that on the evening news or on the History Channel and so on, other sources. So we realize we need to get the word out. Good stuff coming from the scientists at Answers in Genesis, Creation Ministries, as well as ICR. And so we started by just by showing monthly videos, DVDs that were becoming available. And then I started answering questions, and so we formed the group to do this in a more organized way, just a local creation science group. Mm-hmm. And we have had many meetings in probably a dozen different churches in our area, and that's what we do. We try to do one conference per year as well, just to get the word out that good science does not back Darwinian evolution.
Well, you perhaps are inspiring other individuals who are in perhaps rural areas in South Dakota to the people who are listening in New Hampshire, in Florida, et cetera, who said, you know, I wish I could do something. And that's what you did. You started showing a video and then having some discussion around it. And then, of course, with some of your education, then we're able to answer questions and deal with it. But this would be a great starting point for many as to there's such a plethora of great creation videos out there to bring a group together to show them, have discussion regarding those.
Right. And it does help to have somebody pretty knowledgeable in it that can answer questions. If you don't, you don't have to do that. But I've been looking at this topic now for over 40 years, ever since I graduated from the University of Illinois, which is where I became a Christian, made sure that I had Jesus in my heart. But I had questions about, you know, Neanderthals and Lucy fossil and dinosaurs and C-14. And so I approached it as an engineer, and, you know, the answers are pretty amazing. You don't have to scratch the surface very far, and then you find that just the whole story falls apart.
It's not a common place to find Christ, a Savior, on a college campus or around that era in your life. What was it that propelled you? What drew you to Christ at that time? And then specifically, what drew you to your interest in this topic of origins, creation versus evolution?
Well, like many people, I had a good Christian parents who, you know, took me to their church, and I understood the gospel. But when I first started at the University of Illinois, I had a professor that said, if you want to do science, you cannot believe in God. And if you believe in God, you can't do science. So those were hard words for a young engineering student because I wanted to do science. I was a little bit of a science geek. But fortunately, God brought a lot of people into my life that, among other things, showed me apologetics. And at that time, Josh McDowell materials was very relatively fresh and plentiful. And I researched the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And I make a long story short, just determined that that really happened. That was an event in history. There's a lot of good information from historians, archaeology, and the whole gospel message, what happened to the apostles. That's what convinced me. And so then I wanted to make sure as a Christian, invited Jesus into my heart, forgive me all my sins. And in the next 5 years, I picked up a couple of engineering degrees. I did science, but I was also studying the Bible more than any engineering book. Hmm. And so that's what got me going. Apologetics played a role in me staying the course, following Christ Jesus and studying his word. But I always had questions, and the creation evolution thing is what I've been looking at for 40 plus years.
Well, we often hear that mantra today, Helmut, that says follow the science, as I pointed out at the beginning of the program today. And you're here today, though, to say why evolution is not good science. Matter of fact, you say that evolution is bad science. And before we get into the reasons why, there are many who are taught to believe that science and evolution are synonymous terms. But you're disagreeing with that.
I really am. What we need to do is learn the difference between the actual facts of science and what scientists say. Scientists are just, you know, other people, men and women who have a particular worldview. And so they can look at the facts of science and interpret it their way. But if we can look at the facts of science and say, wait a minute, this really doesn't fit the Darwinian narrative. In fact, it's just the opposite.
Mm-hmm. So as we hear in our culture today, as you heard back then, you must deny science in order to be a creationist. But you find that to be the great contradiction, that you don't have to deny science to be a creationist.
No, I'm an engineer. I had to do science in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And when in engineering, you work with scientific facts and data and learning to analyze data. And if the data leads you in a certain way, you got to, especially when it contradicts your worldview, you've got to ask the question, am I willing to follow the science, even if it's not where I like to go? And I know in academia today, there are a lot of people who just don't like the fact that it's pointing us to the Bible, the God of creation, and Jesus is our Savior.
Again, we're going to get into this issue but I also learned that you're president of Creation Summit, and that really gives a special burden to college and university campuses across the nation.
Yeah, Creation Summit was founded with the burden of reaching people in the locations where evolution thrives the best, and that is on college campuses and, unfortunately, seminaries. So we try to do one major conference per semester on a college campus of some type. Creation Summit has done that at Michigan State, Idaho State, Oklahoma State. We were at North Carolina a few years ago when I got involved, and then also at Concordia Seminary, just to reinforce the creation account, and then at Trinity International University, where we hope to be this fall.
And what are you hoping to accomplish through these, and what has been the response to these?
Well, the goal is just to show that there are PhD, highly qualified scientists who believe the Bible, and they present from their area of specialty, whether it's genetics or geology, the fact that the real facts are consistent with the biblical accounts in Genesis 1 through 11 especially. And so we just want to get that word out that you can follow science and the Bible at the same time, because they do converge. They come together in one truth. And so the response, you know, is mixed. You get people who just discount you. You get called names. But if we can reach, you know, 100 students who come out and listen, and if a good percentage of them are swayed to follow the Lord Christ, or at least get involved in a Bible study, mm-hmm. start taking that seriously and investigate the claims of Christ, then we've reached our goal.
Amen. Amen. And the response so far to this?
It's been about that. We get 100 to 300 people.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly students coming to some of these. Sometimes it's a little less. Sometimes we've had standing room only, like when they did a debate at Oklahoma State. It's getting harder to do debates, but the response has been good. It's been energetic in some places.
Why is it getting harder?
It's getting harder because you're finding that the evolutionists don't want a debate. They hear debate, and in my opinion, and that's just me, they hide under their desks because it used to be pretty easy to get a debate because they were very confident they would win. But they're realizing that they don't always win. In fact, most of the time, they don't look so good when you get a little challenged, you know, like these fossils that they present, or how can mutations create new and better forms, more complex information. People are realizing you get a little bit of those facts of science out there and the story doesn't look that good.
And yet this flawed worldview they continue to promote through their courses and areas of study.
Yeah, if you're a little bit of astute in just general politics, you know how propaganda can go a long way.
Wow. Well, Helmut Welk is with us here today in studio, president of the Quad City Creation Science Association, Why Evolution is Bad Science. And there's many reasons why evolution is bad science. We're going to focus on three key reasons today why that is the case. And reason number one, you say, is origin of life. Tell us why origin of life tells us that evolution is bad science.
Well, basically, it says that evolution cannot get started and that the origin of life has become scientifically impossible, statistically. Now, evolutionists, and I've had people tell me that, well, that's not really part of the theory of evolution. We don't know where the first cell came into being or how, but once it did, then, you know, you can go from a single cell to multi-celled to a jellyfish to a bony fish to something walking on land, etc., all the plants. But it is part of the story. If you look at any biology textbook, they talk about some primordial soup where the first cell formed into existence. And if you try to, you know, ignore God, then it just gets scientifically impossible for the first cell to happen. So evolution cannot get started. And there have been atheists who've realized that and changed their mind. One of the world's most prominent atheists before Richard Dawkins was Anthony Flew, I believe. And he realized, as he kept up with science, that as we were looking into DNA, he realized it was information. And information comes only from an intelligent mind, a source, if it's going to communicate anything. And he realized that DNA is. And he says what the DNA material has done is show us that there is a greater intelligence, that there is somebody out there that created this, that wrote the code. And so that is just one of the many reasons, along with biochemistry, the amino acids and stuff, that just does not make the initial origin of life, the first cell popping into existence, it makes that statistically impossible.
Yes, because we can't come up with the reason what brought about that first entity, whether it's soup or nuts.
that's exactly right.
What brought it about.
So, you know, they like to talk about hot vents in the ocean or some type of the right chemicals, but you cannot go from inorganic, inanimate material into organic life. That step has just gotten harder and harder. I had a
tell you what, we're going to have to pick up after the break. Helmut Welk with us here in studio. Why Evolution is Bad Science. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, creation author with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, you say that there was no death before Adam sinned. But what about plants? I mean, didn't Adam eat plants?
Yes, Chris. Adam and Eve did eat plants in the Garden of Eden. But was this really death in the biblical sense? There's a profound theological distinction between plants and animals in the Bible. Both man and the animals are described as having life, Hebrew nephesh, which plants don't have. The term life is reserved for those animals in whose nostrils is the breath of life, and also by the fact that life is in the blood. Plants have neither breath nor blood. Thus, the eating of a plant in the Garden of Eden wouldn't necessarily involve death. Plants are biologically alive, but they're not biblically alive in the sense that they do not have true life. You see, Chris, there's always an answer to the anti-creationist questions. Back to Genesis. Now that works.
Thanks, Dr. Morris.
Why Evolution is Bad Science. Our guest today, Helmut Welk, who is president of the Quad City Creation Science Association. By the way, their website is qccsa.org, standing for Quad City Creation Science Association, qccsa.org. And talking here today on this topic, as a matter of fact, they've got a number of different talks, presentations available through their organization, a lot of resources through their website as well, which you can check out. Helmut, we were talking about this, why evolution is bad science, and that first point you had presented is the origin of life, where that first speck came from, that first cell came from to bring about, supposedly, that chain of events that brought us to us today. Some have called it goo to you. You were hearing an interesting debate. Tell us what was going on in that debate.
I was at another college campus, and there was a debate on the historicity of the Bible. And a professor of philosophy, of course, was the atheist, and he teaches that to his students, which is some of the experience I had as a grad student, undergrad student as well. But I challenged this person in a side conversation about the origin of life. And he just said, oh, they're working on it. We're getting closer all the time. Mm. We don't know for sure. They admit that, but we're getting closer.
Wow.
And the truth is, they're not. They're getting further away from it. They're finding more and more problems. The chance of hundreds of amino acids lining up in the correct sequence, and it has to be correct, to make even a simple protein or a complex protein, the odds are impossible. And one of the key points is that amino acids in life have to be only left-handed amino acids. When they form naturally, and with the Miller-Urey experiment from the 1950s, they did form 2% amino acids in this experiment, but it's equal amounts of left-handed and right-handed. Amino acids are a 3D molecule, like the left-hand and right-hand side of your car door, your car doors. You can't take a right-hand car door and put it on the left-hand side, even though the internal components may be identical. It's the same thing with some proteins. You can't use right-handed proteins. They have to be the left-handed ones only. Hmm. In chance experiments, they only get left and right. They get both left and right-handed, 50-50, which is what you expect statistically.
Mm-hmm.
But only left-handed ones are used in life, the proteins that make you you. And that has become a big thorny problem, even more so than just making amino acids in general and then having them line up as proteins. So the left-handed, or it's called chirality, a handedness, has become an increasingly large problem to this day in trying to explain the origin of life. So evolution could not get started by itself.
Okay, so I'm going to turn the tables on your helmet here, because you said, okay, evolution is bad science because they cannot deal with this issue of origin of life. What about you as a creationist? Do you have an answer to this? Do you feel like you're getting closer to an answer as to the origin of life? Or do you know that answer?
Well, I think I know the answer. And of that, of course, we find that in the Bible. In mm-hmm. the beginning, God created. And then he gives us, in Genesis 1, 6 easy steps on how to create a universe and everything in it. Now, he just gives us the outline, but it's very clear, if you read that, that God had to create life, and that every kind of life, and it gives us a few samples, mm-hmm. but every kind is going to reproduce after its own kind. And that is key. Today, we know the reason is DNA. The genetic molecules allow only a certain type of life to recreate itself.
And this
and
really,
that's our second point.
Yeah, I was going to mention that brings us right to our second point, why evolution is bad science. The reason number two is genetics. So what does genetics have to do with this?
Okay, well, the theory, let's just say somehow that first cell popped into existence, and then the story goes that it turned into multicellular creatures, ever more complex. And as it goes through those series, you know, into a bony fish, where suddenly you have an exoskeleton, now we have an internal skeleton with complete with rib cage. And if you've ever cleaned a fish, I imagine they do that here in Wisconsin once in a while, mm-hmm. All the organs are inside the rib cage. Well, somehow that developed, and then somehow this thing walked on the land. So this is an amazing process. of ever more complexity being put into the genome, the DNA, the blueprints of life to make a bony fish or to make a T-Rex. And sometimes they never even mention all the plants. Remember, that same cell had to turn into oak trees, pine trees, rose bushes, as well as every animal form you can think of. That's a fantastic story, and you have to have some mechanism that makes sense to accept that. Now, neo-Darwinism tries to say that there's mutations, there's copying mistakes for whatever reason in generations of DNA. And every once in a while, there's a good mutation, and it's not just a good mutation, but it has to add a lot of new information. It's like adding pages to a set of blueprints to make something more complex and to do it in reasonable steps. Well, DNA doesn't do that. Mutations cannot do that. Hmm. You could argue that maybe one out of a million you get a good mutation, but statistically, if you're at 99.99% bad, they overwhelm anything good that happens. And in fact, modern geneticists today are realizing that our genome does not go on this upward curve that evolutionists believe, that over time DNA gets more complex to make more and better structures, more and better complex creatures. Instead, what we're seeing is that mutations are real, all right, but they are leading to a loss of information. Our genome is declining. We're going down. As Dr. John Sanford, a world-class geneticist, says, we are going down, not up in our genome.
Very interesting. Incidentally, there is this continued teaching. I'm going to bring this in here at this point about man evolving from apes. And some will look at the origins and the genetic code, and they'll say, listen, humans and chimps share 98.8% of their DNA. How do you respond to that? I mean, look at all the similarity here. How can you deny the genetic code doesn't link us together to apes?
Well, that number has been around for quite a while. I think I heard it when I was even in college, and that's just been a few decades ago, let's say. But it really got a lot of prominence in, I think it was in the early 2000s, 2005, some science journals came out with that number. And that was the headline number, that we're 98.8% similar, or something close to that. And that's what the media and evolutionists have run with ever since. But if you even got into the details then, they weren't comparing the entire genome. In fact, the human genome wasn't even mapped until 2001, and the ape genome has not been completely mapped even today. Now, they thought they had a finished product in 2012, I think, somewhere in there. But then we realized it had a lot of contamination from human DNA handling the materials, as well as they went with the assumption, well, we know we came from apes, therefore we're going to use the human genome as a scaffold or a model to build the chimp genome. And of course, that's a bad assumption if you don't know that for sure. So that has led to a lot of problems, and that actual number of 98.8, if you really dig into it, they only compared 97 genes. They cherry-picked ones that they knew were similar. And we have 20,000 genes that code for proteins and another 20-plus thousand that control genes, that are controlling genes. There is no such thing as junk DNA. No geneticist uses that term anymore. So you've got this massive amount that was ignored. And so, yeah, we're made out of some of the same amino acids and proteins, so you can get a high number. But even then, they ignored some problems. And the chimp genome turns out to be built very differently than human, to the point you can't even calculate a numeric difference. Some numbers that have been published, including by secular researchers who believe in evolution, such as Richard Buggs, from the Professor of Evolutionary Genomics in the University of London, he came up with a number that were only about 84% similar. Now, when you think about a 3 billion nucleotide genome, 15% is a massive number, and it has to be done right. And even in 3.5 million, 4 million years that they envision for this change to occur, It's impossible. There have been very good computer programming, programming and simulations done. What it takes, how long can it take to change just a few nucleotides, not just at from random changes, but then you finally have to pick the right ones, and supposedly natural selection does that, you know, to increase brain size, to give the ability to speak and so on, to go from chimp to human. There are a ton of changes that have to be made. And statistically, it also has to be fixed in a population. If one or two individuals have the right mutation, well, that may not get fixed, because they talk about 20,000 hominids that could walk upright and were slowly becoming human. But you got to have that fix, that mutation, to do something new and different from a chimp on the way to becoming human, that enough of the population has that same mutation and it has to become fixed. Otherwise, it could die away. And then you have to wait for it to start over again. So statistically, if you wanted to change just a handful of nucleotides, just a tiny amount of the base pairs in our DNA in the right direction, you're talking about waiting for billions of years, older than the Earth itself, just to go a few steps from a chimp to a human. So not only do we have big differences between chimp and human DNA, to even do a little fraction of those changes would take enormous amounts of time that even evolutionists don't have.
Well, very interesting. Matter of fact, you have put out a paper called Planet of the Apes, or Created in the Image of God. You have a teaching DVD on this as well. Mm-hmm. That's available through your website?
Yes.
And again, that website is qccsa.org.
You can also contact us via email at info@qccsa.org.
Very good. Well, let's get to the third reason why evolution is bad science. And the third reason is that of fossils. Tell us about it.
That's right. The first one is it couldn't start. The second one, it cannot happen. That's genetics. Third one is it did not happen. So let's say somehow it did. Well, then we should have a record of that, right, in the fossil record. And they like to claim that there's lots of evidence of evolution in the fossil record. But of course, we have this issue of missing links. And you all know why they call them that.
Tell us why.
Because they're missing.
Yeah.
And it's not just one or two or three or four. I mean, we're talking about the hundreds of steps that have to be all there. So even Darwin acknowledged this. He had a whole chapter in his original Origins book asking, you know, well, why don't we see more of transitional links in the fossil record? And so he just said that up, well, we're just beginning to explore, and someday we'll find them. Well, today we're still looking. We have actually found billions of fossils. We have cataloged in museums and universities hundreds of millions of fossils. And you know what? The missing links are still missing. They have some candidates, but they've all been proven to be not good candidates.
We're going to come back with this after the break. We'll also have some time for you to call in your questions here shortly. Our guest today, Helmut Welk, and we'll be back talking about why evolution is bad science here on Crosstalk.
Common Core is a new label for state-controlled public education standards in an ongoing attempt to dumb down the American educational system, a struggle that has raged for decades. To help parents and grandparents become knowledgeable on this issue comes the DVD, Escaping Common Core. In this presentation, you'll see how Common Core relates to previous initiatives, such as Goals 2000, No Child Left Behind, and Race to the Top. You'll learn about the influence of men like John Dewey and Horace Mann and their impact on education today. You'll see how Common Core brainwashes children and has a deliberate push toward globalism. And you'll learn how to set your children free from the clutches of Common Core. This DVD is over 60 minutes long and is a must-see presentation. Escaping Common Core is available for a donation of $18 or more by calling VCY America at 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Helmut Welk is our guest here today, and he is from the Quad City Creation Science Association. Incidentally, he's in the area because he's going to be speaking in Kenosha tonight at 6:30 p.m. That's going to be held at the Prayer House Church, 1525 24th Avenue in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And your topic tonight is?
Is the relevance of Genesis today. Basically asking the question, why are so many youth walking away from the faith?
Wow.
From church by the time they're in their 20s.
Compelling topic, and that's going to be discussed tonight, 6:30 p.m. Again, that's at Prayer House Church in Kenosha. It gets underway at 6:30 till 7:30 p.m. We're discussing today why evolution is bad science, and it is various evidences that you provided for us. You had talked about the first reason regarding the origin of life itself, genetics. We're talking right now about fossils. And this is the fossil record that we're still trying to find those missing links, those transitional fossils. Have we found any transitional fossils?
Well, evolutionists claim there are a lot, and you could find websites with a whole list of them, but you don't have to dig much into the details, and you find out that they're disqualified. A very prominent one today is what's something called Tiktaalik. That is a fossil of a walking fish that supposedly is a lobe-finned fish, and there are many lobe-finned fish. Decades ago, another candidate was coelacanth, also supposedly a fish that would decided it wanted to live on land, and the front fins were turning into legs. That was disqualified because we found that fish living today after supposedly missing in the fossil record for 80 million years. And there it is, swimming in the Pacific Ocean. What it does have some bones. That's what they call them, lobe-finned fish. So it has some bones in the front fins, but they're not connected to the backbone in any way. It just gives, they're like stiffeners that make it a very good swimmer, which it is. It swims very good even backwards. Tiktaalik was found, and also called a lobe-finned fish. It was found in northern Canada. The primary researcher was Professor Shubin from the University of Chicago. And they made a big show about this, saying, here we finally got proof of a fish turning into an amphibian. But they really stretched a lot of it. And if you get into some of the details, it did not have lungs, even though in some videos, the proponents of Tiktaalik say, well, it's got elementary or preliminary lungs forming. But the fossil itself has no indication of lungs and does have indications of gills. And it doesn't have any connection between the few bones that are in the front fins to the backbones. And yet the illustrations in museums, books, show this creature using its front fins to hold itself up. And it has a very large head, a flat head with the eyes on top. And so it's a significant, heavy, creature in the front end, and without a connection to the backbone and some stronger bones and joints, there's no way it can hold itself out of the water. But that's how it's shown to school children. And that's, structurally impossible. It just can't do it. It's just another lobe-finned fish. It has no elementary lungs. It has gills. And if you look at it closely, today, we can find a dusky flathead, which is a living fish. It looks identical to the bones of Tiktaalik. It's got the big flathead with the eyes on top. It likes to sit on the bottom of shallow waters, surrounded by silt, and then it lunges forward to catch its food. And we have video of this. And people, and especially in Australia, they think it's a good eating fish, so they catch it. But if you look at the fish itself, and then you look at Tiktaalik, the actual bones and not the illustrations, you see, wow, that's practically the same. Same size, same everything. See, Tiktaalik, which is held up as a transitional form, and it's coming into the textbooks today, it's just another fake, another thing that doesn't work. And that we we call these living fossils, things that are in the fossil record that disappear. Maybe they went extinct, but then we find a lot of them alive, and the living samples look exactly like the fossil. And that's true of like the Wollemi pine tree, coelacanth, bats, honeybees. We find lots of fossils, and they're identical to what we have today.
Hmm. Wow.
No transitional links.
So you would say the fossil record is an evidence of creation.
Absolutely. A special creation of every created kind.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number to Crosstalk today is 800-733-9829. Perhaps something Helmut has said has prompted a question in your mind. Maybe there's something that's been puzzling you through this process, and you'd like to ask a question here today of our guest. Our number, 1-800-733-9829. We'll take as many questions as time will permit here today and welcome your phone calls, 1-800-733-9829. How is it that you can look at all of these evidences, and evolutionists will look at all of these evidences, and yet come up with some very different conclusions? Why does that happen? How does it happen?
Well, it really gets down to a difference of worldviews, what you want to believe, how you prefer things to be, and if you're already biased against a personal God for whatever reason or something that happened in your past. And we've got so many people. I understand that creation is a minority view among scientists, but there are tens of thousands of qualified world-class scientists who do hold to the biblical creation view, but that is a minority. So it's tough to go against the minority. Unfortunately, in academia, it's gotten worse. When I was younger, you could still find a lot of college professors of all kinds who professed the Bible and a belief in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That's getting whittled down heavily today.
Wow.
To the point that if you even mention that you doubt Darwin or you're a little skeptical, usually being a skeptic is a good thing in their worldview, but if you're skeptical about Darwin, you can lose funding. If you're not tenured, you can lose tenure, and that has happened. So it's really become the closed community, and that's why we like going to college campuses, at least to present the alternative opinion.
Yeah, and friends, sadly, this is happening in churches across the nation, and Lord willing, this coming Monday, Ken Ham will be with us here on Crosstalk, and our topic on Monday is deplatforming Genesis. Not what's going on at the college university campus, but what's happening within many a church across this nation. So plan to join us for that broadcast as well. Well, we've got our calls all lined up here each line tied up at the moment. Sergey in Pennsylvania, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, my question is, how old is the earth since Adam and Eve? And then just follow up, if God created the world 6 days and rested on the seventh, how come he couldn't have rested on the day that this radio station was created? Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Well, you don't have to talk about creation and evolution very long, and someone asked that question. Thank you, Sergey. My standard answer has become this when someone asks me, well, how old do you think the Earth is? And I have to give them a little background. There are maybe up to 100 ways you can measure or get an indication of the age of the Earth. Scientific methods, data-based methods, and over 95% of them indicate that our planet can only be thousands of years old, not millions or billions. And these are scientific methods, like the decline of the Earth's magnetic field. That's what convinced a Dr. Russ Humphreys, who grew up in a non-Christian home, and he did. He's an award-winning physicist when he was doing graduate work. He realized that Earth's magnetic field is declining at such a rate that if you actually studied it and then worked backwards from origins, if you go back much more than 20,000 years, the Earth would be a mess, would be too hot for life to have lived to live on. So he uses that method as a cap of the age of the Earth of 20,000 years. There are other methods that might give you 50,000 years, maybe as much as 100,000, but those are maximums. And as I indicated, we've got maybe 100 indicators that say, no, the Earth can't be millions and billions of years old. That's what we're taught. I was taught that from childhood on. But when you get into the science, they really don't have good, hard methods to back those ages up. So, you know, I just go back to and say, well, why not just follow the Bible? If God created and he says and indicates, you know, from the generations and so on, that it's under 10,000 years, why not go with that?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, as an engineer, I like to refer to data, and we've got tons of data.
And six literal 24-hour days, and I think the caller was asking here, you know, why did he rest on that seventh day?
Well, I think that's a good question, because it does come up even in the Ten Commandments to have a day of rest, a Sabbath. That's how we were created.
Mm-hmm.
We are meant to work, you know, 6 days and then take a day of rest, not work nonstop. So that pattern of a week, 6 days of work, a day of rest, is what God instilled in us from the very beginning, because it's healthy for us, but also it points us to a regular time where we worship him, our creator. And that's embedded in the Exodus when he gives us the Ten Commandments. So, yeah, we should take that day of rest. And that's every culture on earth practically has a seven-day week.
Yeah.
And it's not from astronomical signs. It's from the Bible.
Some tried to change that, but it didn't work. Let's go next to Wayne in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Wayne, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, verse 1 talks about God creating the heaven and the earth, and verse 2 talks about the great darkness. And have you heard of the gap theory? If you would comment on between those two verses.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne.
Okay. I'm not a Hebrew expert, but I've been told that there is no gap in the sentence structure from verse 1 to verse 2. So that's kind of artificially added. The gap theory has actually been around since probably early 1800s, well before Darwin, because there were amateur geologists in England like Hutton, and then another generation later, Lyell, who taught that the rocks must be millions of years old. They had not graduated to billions yet. They are still on the millions. But they made a convincing case, and so some theologians thought, okay, well, we'll accommodate that, and maybe there's a gap between Genesis 1 and 2. I don't think the Hebrew allows that. Second, you have to really understand the six steps of creation. In fact, that's what I talked on in northern Wisconsin just recently, understanding the first 4 days of creation, cosmology. Day one, which God goes right into from verse 1, is he talks only about waters. And the earth was kind of formless, but then by the end of the day, you must have gravity kicking in, because it talks about the Spirit of God hovering over the surface of the waters. So I think before anything, at the beginning of time, and Dr. Humphreys, by the way, is a good proponent on this. He backs it up very well, and I borrow a lot of material from him. But he would say that there was gravity working, and that before verse 1 even, there was no universe, right? We all agree with that. There was nothing there, just God himself. Step 1 was creating a large, massive, spinning ball of water, and at the end of day 1, we have water, we have light, and the beginning of time.
Hmm. Very interesting. Thank you for the call. We'll pick up with some other questions right after the break. Our number to Crosstalk is 800-733-9829. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brennan House. Our website, worldviewreport.com. Free speech is under assault today, and this has led CEO Mike Lindell to develop a new social media platform launching April 19th that is all about free speech, a platform for free speech. But does that mean he'll allow anyone to come on his social media and broadcast platform and say whatever they want? The answer is no. Why? Will he thus then be doing what he's been complaining about, suppressing free speech? No. Because there is a limit to speech. You can't scream fire in a building. You can be sued if you libel or slander someone. You can't make terroristic threats. And, well, obscenity is not part of free speech. But in America, we have a real blessing. As we defend a Christian worldview, the Judeo-Christian worldview, we're also defending a constitutional republic. Because William Blackstone, the leading scholar for the Founding Fathers, said, whatever the divine has ruled on, we don't rule against. Therefore, abortion, gay marriage, and the such, the divine has ruled. Therefore, we don't promote it.
Why Evolution is Bad Science, our topic today. Helmut Welk, our guest, and from the Quad City Creation Science Association. Again, their website is QCCSA.org. That stands for Quad City Creation Science Association, QCCSA.org. Their email address is info@QCCSA.org. A reminder, if you're in the Kenosha area this evening, Kenosha, Wisconsin, he'll be speaking tonight, 6:30 p.m. at the Prayer House Church, 1524 24th Avenue in Kenosha. In addition to that, he'll be involved in an online conference as well, a Creation Truth online conference that gets underway on April the 17th. It's a full-day conference. He'll be speaking. Dr. Marcus Ross will be speaking. Dr. Jeff Tompkins, Tompkins has another presentation as well, a panel discussion. There is a registration cost for that, but anybody can join that online, I believe.
Yes, you can join online. We ask that you pre-register by Friday night at creationtoday.org/truth. And if you register and you don't have time to watch everything on Saturday, you will receive a link where you can watch the individual sessions at your leisure for about 10 days afterward.
Very good. We're going to pick up our next call. This is Keith in Apache Junction, Arizona. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hi. I'm enjoying the conversation very much.
Great.
Are you folks familiar with the great movie Inherit the Wind, which was loosely based on the Scopes Monkey Trial in Dayton, Tennessee? It was Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan battled it out, creationism versus evolution, when a young biology teacher in the schools there was arrested for teaching evolution. And that was the first such debate set out over the radio. And there's a very interesting line in the movie. Stanley Kramer, who made the movie, was very pro-evolution, and he slanted the facts. But the local preacher got up and said, and told him, if you start preaching evolution in the schools, we are just a few generations away from Sodom and Gomorrah. Hmm. Well, guess what? Sodom and Gomorrah is here.
Hmm.
And it's a great movie. It's not entirely accurate. And William Jennings Bryan was very, you know, he ran for president several times. He was very pro-creationism, and he was concerned because the evolutionists were bleeding over into the social construct of society and using social evolution to weed out inferior races, which, guess what, Adolf Hitler did. And Clarence Darrow, who's this famous attorney, he was an atheist. The story is when he died, he called in a priest, a rabbi, and a Protestant minister because he wasn't taking any chances, even though when he was alive, he was a raving atheist. But anyway, great story, great movie, and thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you, Keith, for the call. And I'm sure you're familiar with that film.
Yeah, very much so. In fact, there's a lot of material out there. In fact, I would not recommend the movie because it's extremely biased and not factual.
Mm-hmm.
Inherit the Wind is a product of Hollywood, loosely based on that trial in the 1920s. But they show, I think it was Scope, the teacher in the trial, they show him in prison with a whole bunch of people out there ready to do a hanging party on him for teaching evolution. The truth is that teacher never spent a night in jail, not one. He was treated with respect, and when Clarence Darrow came to town, the atheist, he was treated with respect. He even wrote that these are wonderful people, I don't believe the same, but they are treating me very nicely. And then a lot of facts get twisted in that movie. Unfortunately, it did change opinion in America because it was the first debate on radio, and newspaper coverage was around the world.
Wow.
And in my talk on apes, I mentioned in the 1920s, we still had a bunch of frauds that were held up as examples of us coming from apes. Like Piltdown Man, that was still a prominent evidence that we came from apes.
Sure.
Nebraska Man had just hit the news wires. And today we know that was nothing but a single pig's tooth. And then I think Java Man may have been on the scene by then, and a couple of others. And every one of them has turned out to be totally wrong or an outright fraud, like Piltdown Man. So a lot of bad information was made public, and the public opinion got turned against creation for a lot of bad reasons.
We've got Maxine next in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I was going to ask, why are dinosaurs so popular, even in Christian homes?
Oh, they're amazing creatures. I personally like dinosaurs, and I think there's no doubt they were real. But I have a whole talk on dinosaurs, which I just did last week, and the evidence that is coming in from dinosaur bones, supposedly 80, 65, or more million years old, have soft biological tissue in them. Now, I mean collagen, a whole bunch of proteins, material that should not be there. It should have turned to dust, be gone, or totally fossilized. And yet we have biological material in these bones that cannot last for 100,000 years. So the dinosaurs are not that old.
So you don't have to deny dinosaurs in order to believe in creation.
Oh, no. We've got their bones. And Behemoth, I think, was a sauropod dinosaur, if you read Job 40 carefully.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you, Maxine.
Okay, man. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dennis in Warsaw, Indiana. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I have a comment about the gap theory. Now, you won't find I used to teach seminary, Greek and Hebrew, and theology, and you won't find everyone who believes this, of course, but if you look at verse 1 of Genesis 1 and chapter 12:1, the Hebrew does allow for those two verses to be a summary verse, an introductory verse. And so what has happened, it's a growing school of thought that the actual details of the creation begin in verse 2. So you might want to consider that. And for your other listeners, that Genesis 1:1 is a summary verse or an introductory verse, and the actual details begin in verse 2.
Right.
So you look at it one way, and it does look like a gap, but it's not. It's just an introductory verse. The Hebrew does allow for that to be an introductory summary verse.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your call here today. We've got 20 seconds left. What would you like to leave with our listeners?
Well, finally, I think we need to remember Colossians 2:8, and that says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception according to the tradition of men, according to elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ." Folks, that's what I'm going to talk about tonight in Kenosha, House of Prayer. We need to see to it that our children and grandchildren are foundations are in the Bible, and that we can trust it from the very first verse.
We're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Hamid, for being with us.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.